So thank you to Mike and everyone at Jamyang. Very kind, all that he's saying. I don't know how much of it is true, but so I'm delighted really to be back here. And so thank you for coming. So I noticed there are a lot more people here than I think last year when I taught. So I imagine, you know, people are having a little interest in stress and anxiety, right? Anyone in the metropolis area of London, right? It's usually, I think most of the world is having issues with stress and anxiety that I find as I teach around the world. So also, I know we are from different cultures here, so if you have any difficulty understanding me or don't understand a word, you know, something I'm saying, just please raise your hand. And like that. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Thank you. Great. So do you normally start with prayers that you want to do some inspiring prayers? Most people have these booklets, correct? Okay. And just share, and you can just look on with someone else. Is there any particular thing normally that... Okay, because it's nice to kind of do what the center normally does. I sometimes have my own style, but yeah, this is nice, something simple. And what I'd like you to do first, and a lot of you are very familiar, have quite a Buddhist background, is to, let's just sit for a moment before we launch into the prayers. What I find with my own practice, what I find really helpful is a lot of you have daily practices to do, I imagine. And sometimes it's just blah, 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 right? So it's much more meaningful, the practices. They will stay juicy for you when you actually think about what you're saying and have a motivation that it comes from here. So what happens is we get lazy. And how many of you have been around about 5, 10 years in the Dharma? Anybody? Okay, so some newcomers. Other people newer, correct? Okay. So once you, if you're interested in a spiritual path such as this one, and not everyone is, that's fine. But it gets dried up after about 20 years. You get bored, and sometimes sooner, right? So you have to kind of reconnect with your practice, and you can alternate prayers, but it's good to really think about what am I saying? So this is a refuge and bodhicitta prayer. And if you don't know what that means, refuge is a place where we go for protection, right? Shelter, protection, something safe. Okay. So when you think in your own lives, because it seems like there's a lot of newcomers here as well, where do you go for safety and protection? I'm just curious. Anybody? What do you do when you get... You go home, right? Some kind of comfort, right? If you have that kind of nest like that. And what else do you do? You? Family and friends, right? And who said? The pizza shop. Okay, so you go to food. We go to food, right? Refrigerator. Television. Oh, you're here. Hello. I asked about you. I'm so glad to see you. Wonderful. But yeah, I didn't see you last year, right? So I was like, how is she? Where is she? Wonderful. There's some other people. How many of you have been in the class I did before here? Curious. Okay. Right. So we go to food. We go to TV, movies, recreation, music, friends, family, home, like this. So how many of them are infallible support? For you, when you get into trouble, I mean, when you're depressed, when you're kind of freaking out sometimes, we always have these moments. How many of them really totally support you? Think about it. Right? Not so much, yeah? So temporarily, sure, it's a great fix. Long-term wise, but the thing is, you yourself have to check, do your refuges support you? How much do they support you? How long-term do they support you? Does the problem go away? Yeah. So if pizza was really a source of happiness, the more pizza you eat, the happier you get. That's how true sources of happiness, that's how they exist. Chocolate, right? No, the more chocolate you eat, too much chocolate, and you're sick. So it's not a true source, right? So if you really look for a true source of happiness, like love, true source of happiness, I mean real love, okay? Okay, but we're not going to go too heavily. That's another course. You have to go to Cumbria for that topic. And, you know, we're doing something on love and attachment, right? Okay, so let's think about refuge. So the beginning of this formula, a lot of you are familiar, I know, with this. This prayer, it's a very short prayer. It's four lines in Tibetan. Is you realize, you know, things could be a lot worse, and I'm actually generated by a little bit of fear about that. Yeah. So Buddhism is not a fearful religion, but the fear, if you have a little bit of fear generated, okay, it's a motivator to practice. You know, you think of others and you think, wow, things could be worse for me. So it motivates you to practice. It doesn't paralyze you. It's not that kind of spirituality. Okay. And from that fear, I start to think about, it would be really incredible if I myself, even the suffering I experience in this life as it is now, if I could overcome that permanently, which you can do on this path, that would be incredible. Permanently get myself out of the suffering. Great, okay? But and so building on that, all these other beings are still suffering. Even if I'm free, all these other beings are suffering. And so as a Buddhist, sometimes we're not satisfied with that. So then I commit myself, the second word, bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, Sanskrit word for the enlightened attitude. Bodhi is enlightenment. Citta, mind, the mind of enlightenment. Okay, the mind of enlightenment is about cherishing others more than myself. Thinking, and that's where all your happiness comes from anyway. Okay. So then I turn and think all these other beings are suffering, but if I could reach a place where I am unlimited in helping them, becoming a Buddha, we would say in this tradition, okay, or an enlightened being, or Buddha means awakened. Awakening, awakened being. So if I'm fully awake, we say in this tradition, fully awake, fully enlightened, then I have every capacity to benefit all others. Fully empowered. So that's the refuge bodhicitta formula. That's what that prayer is about. Okay? So just taking a moment to think about that. Kind of come from the heart, really wishing to benefit all others. We'll read this prayer twice in English, and one time we'll do the Tibetan chant so you can hear how it sounds. Feel free to join in if you'd like. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye Jodan Soki Chonam La Janshu Bardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Junengi Peso Namgi La Pencher Sangye Drupajo. Let's take a moment, just close your eyes lightly. And just sit up straight. And just allow your mind to settle here into the space. And allow yourself to let go the various activities of the day, distractions, this is your time to indulge yourself by being here. and begin to bring your awareness to your breath. Just a normal, natural breath. And follow the space just outside the nostrils where the air enters in and leaves your body. So if and when the mind wanders off of the object, the breath, running after a distraction, simply become aware without any further story or elaboration and gently bring the mind back to the breath. Slowly, when you're ready, please open your eyes. And so I don't forget, I brought these. These are, I just came back from India yesterday, and I had the good fortune, as Mike said, I did a lot of retreat this year in Nepal and India. So these just came from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. These are mani pills. They're tiny little herbal pills, and anyone who would like, no obligation, you could come up and I'll give you a few, and you can put one under your tongue and you let it dissolve. And you can give to people, and it's quite nice to think, you know, it's from like the Buddha of compassion, and it just kind of heals, you know, the body. It's just a blessing, incredible blessing. So mani pills. like that, so I just wanted to, I'm afraid I'll forget, so that's why I thought I'll mention it now. So what's the deal about stress and anxiety, right? That why it attracts so many people as well, and how do we deal with it, frankly? The first thing is just what we just did, a short meditation, but part of the meditation, the key is breathing, So Colm and I were talking yesterday, and what we noticed, a lot of the things I may discuss tonight, and we will have time for questions and answers, is a lot of things you probably already know, but we just need reminders and maybe little techniques and things. And a lot of this path, and a lot of even battling stress and anxiety, it's up to you to change your habits. So unfortunately, this path, it can't be done for you. If the Buddhas could enlighten us, they would do it in a second. It's just not you. So you have to make effort on this path. And I don't think that's any issue for anybody that lives in London about making effort. Okay, we know how to make effort. The problem is we make effort in the wrong directions. Okay, effort isn't any issue. So yesterday, Jerry picked me up, and I was just thinking, and I had a little flash here for a moment, because one of the classes a few years ago, you and Chitra were sitting there, I remembered. So, and unfortunately, she's not with us anymore. So he picked me up, and we took the tube in, and today I was on the tube. And everybody on the tube is making a lot of effort, because they're sitting on the tube like this. And there's a lot of effort put into everything that's going on there in this little mechanism. Okay, so we know how to do effort, and I was just talking to Patrick, who we were talking about how much time you want to devote to your technology. So frankly, a lot of stressors come from this as well. And I'm just, there's nothing inherently wrong with the internet or your smartphone. There's nothing inherently good or bad about it. It's a matter of how attached you are and how much time we can spend wasted by, you know, this website takes me to this website, and did you see? And, you know, you go onto YouTube because somebody sent you a link to something actually very worthwhile, but now, an hour and a half later, I'm into the dancing cat videos. Okay? So again, this is your choice. You have choices every moment. You have choices every day about what I want to spend my time with. You know, no, really, you know, one day I was on there and all of a sudden I was like, what am I doing? Like, you know, I mean, they're cute, but it's, you know, so again, you have choices. You know, we need time for entertainment and giving yourself a break within reason. And what happens, what you find, I find with most people and myself, when you get into a habit where you're wasting a lot of time, you feel guilty. Right? And that guilt adds to stress. You know, it adds to, like, I'm not getting, and you're not getting some things done you wanted to. So these little things build up. When you build up enough of them, you have meltdowns and freakouts. Right? It doesn't have to happen. So I do just ask for, like, you have to yourself, the beginning is to consider how much time am I willing to devote to my freedom? Okay, this is a path of freedom. You know, there's many other spiritual paths, and if you found your own religion and your own way, and it's contributing to your freedom and happiness, then stay with it. You don't need to be Buddhist. Seriously, right? But what I really like about Buddhism, which I think also was in my own spirituality, the own religion I was raised with, but I found it a little bit more accessible in Buddhism, is this is a path to ultimate freedom and happiness for yourself. That's it. So part of it is you have to decide how much freedom do I want. And a lot of the world is really not interested in a lot of freedom and happiness. Okay, we think we are. We say we are. But when it really comes down to it, our actions do not exhibit that and do not move us in that direction. Are you following? I mean, isn't it true like that? I mean, I just look at my own life. And one of my friends, I just spent some time with him in India, him and his partner. He's really he's a Westerner, he's American actually, and he really is a great yogi. He's a very special guy. I think he's got some level of realizations. And one time we were at a big retreat, with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and he looked around the room and he grabbed me and he kind of grabbed my arm and he said, "How many people here do you think really, you know, really want to be free?" He's like, you know, he's like that. Like, and when you think about it, it's like intellectually, we of course we want it, but then our actual actions and things, sometimes not wise, you know, really going in a different direction, okay? So let me go back to the breath. That when you start to tell yourself, "I'm getting stressed, I'm feeling anxious," sometimes it's just a mental trip of a habit that you'll, like, so I know we had this thing going around at centers at one point, "I'm burnt out." Just this phrase, "I'm burnt out." So it was easy to say, "I'm burnt out." But the "I'm burnt out" became this, and it became another habit, right? And you start telling yourself you're burnt out, so you are burnt out. You know, there's other ways, language is very powerful. So when you feel the stress and the anxiety, and some people might label themselves as an anxious person, right, a stressed out person, you stop breathing deeply when these little things happen. So it's also physiological. It seems like the physiological contributes to what's going on in the mind, mentally. So you start shallow breathing. Then you're not getting oxygen to your system. And that can lend to more constriction, okay, in the mind. The mind and body are connected. They're not the same thing, but they're connected. And they ride along for a while together in your life. Okay. So the first thing is you need to have a habit, a pattern, that you interrupt the stressors and the other habitual tendencies of that, of delusion, and which contributes to negativity, and is by breathing. By breathing. A lot of us have meditation practices going on, and that teaches you to breathe fully. You can begin by focusing on the breath. So as simple as what we just did, how many of you have a meditation practice, a little bit going? Okay, great. So you're familiar with that. You're familiar. If you don't have it going, this center is a great place to learn that. And I can't stress it enough, even if it's 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at night. If you start there, right? Because what it does is you have this little foundation in the morning, and I have a little bit of a motivation, and I get myself started. A lot of people, once they start, they find when they miss it one day or a couple days, they're a little bit cranky, a little off kilter. Okay, so through that we learn how to breathe, but any time during the day, what happens is if you have a little bit longer meditation practice, it grows over some years, I start to have a pattern of going back to my breath. And obviously meditations are more than the breath. There can be many different kinds, visualizations and mantra recitation, analytical meditation, many different kinds we do. But often fundamentally we start with the breath. It's quite simple and it's nice. So from there, you start to introduce a new habit or pattern that I'm breathing properly. I'm breathing properly. So as soon as little stressors come, automatically the habit starts to come in. But again, it's going to take time to do that habit, to go back to my breath. What happens, I mean, what are just some examples? I'm just curious. What happens when you get stressed? What do you do? I'm just curious. Anybody notice what happens?
Harsh language.
Any of you snap at people? Right? It's really quick. It's really easy. You know, I've lost control of my mind, and now my mouth opens up. Great. And it's really, you know. So harsh language happens. You don't finish anything. Yep. We're in the middle of a bunch of different things, and I just, too much, overwhelmed. What else do you do?
Isolate.
Retreat. So what happens is these aren't really healthy things. Okay. But if I notice the stressors coming, and you start to get more skillful through practice, and again, this is months and years. This isn't like in 2 days. Please be patient with yourself on this path. You know. So I'm from a culture, United States. Americans want their enlightenment delivered 2 weeks ago in a nice little gold box. It's a tough culture, right? I mean, I love my culture. It's fantastic, very eager people, ready, you know, very enthusiastic to practice. But, you know, we want it easy. We want the easy path, the easy way. One time at a teaching in Los Angeles some years ago with the Dalai Lama, and you could submit questions on a piece of paper at the end, and Thupten Jinpa, his translator, opened one of the questions, and he said, usually the translator, the interpreter, like screens the questions first and doesn't do the kind of maybe not so essential ones. So I thought he would have screened, and it said, what is the easiest way to get enlightened? Could His Holiness tell us? And His Holiness started crying. And when he cries, everybody, you know, it's like the Buddha of compassion crying, everybody gets very silent, and that we've caused His Holiness to cry. And then he manifested a little bit of wrath. And it was actually very powerful for people. And he said, you Americans, you know, you always want it so easy. And it really taught me something about, you know, making effort, that it's worthwhile. So these unhealthy things, these unhealthy patterns, it's, you know, if we could just breathe, you start to notice your mind. You know, and through meditation you start, and through a lot of spiritual practice, you're much more observant of your mind as before it's reacting and as something's going on. So like I can notice my mind. It doesn't mean I don't get stressed because, you know, I'm wearing maroon robes and have a bald head, right? Not at all. I still get stressed with things. And so but what happens now is I'm much more aware as it's coming up. And sometimes I'll just watch myself and I'll say, well, I'm really noticing I've got anxiety in my mind right now. Okay. But you see the difference between I'm stressed to I have anxiety in my mind right now. That's another technique I'm going to explain in a second. And so I'm a little bit more detached from it. And when I'm detached from it, I'm more observant of it. And then I can, and what I now have a habit automatically is when I notice that of, oh, I'm feeling a bit stressed now, I'm noticing anxiety in my mind, is I have an automatic pilot where I go back and I breathe. Well, only because I've trained myself. But I've trained myself over a lot of time, you know, for meditation. So it used to be I would just get more anxious. Like now I'm anxious and oh my God, I shouldn't be anxious. So that's making me more anxious. But now if I go back to the breath, I'll notice that I'm shallow breathing. That's what happens in anxiety. Did you ever notice? I'm not really. So then if I just stop for a moment, and the first breath's a little bit not so full, but the second breath is fuller. And by the third breath, I'm already starting to relax. Easy technique, really easy. Okay, and I'll just give you a few techniques because sometimes breathing doesn't work for people. But again, I had to train myself. I would still feel really anxious after the third breath, but what happens after the third deep breath is I'm gaining some perspective now on whatever I think is causing me stress. My mind's opening up a little bit. If I'm just shallow breathing, you know, the doors and windows are shutting like that. Okay, so another thing is to be aware of the nature of your mind. What does that mean? A lot of you, how many of you have done some courses on the mind in Buddhism? I'm sure some people, yeah. Okay, we have some great courses on the mind. Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism is a lot about the mind. And you learn a lot about a culture and people. And, you know, we know in North America, Eskimos have, I think, something like 11 different words for snow. So obviously, it teaches you they must live in a cold climate with snow. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there's many words for mind. And a lot of what we're doing is a study of the mind and a transformation of the mind. So that's exciting because it means I can transform my stress and anxiety into something more positive. And every other delusion that you cart around, meaning pride, jealousy, desire, attachment, hatred and anger, confusion, ignorance, all can be transformed, right? And why? Because they're not in the nature of the mind. They're not inherent with the mind. There's something that's called adventitious, and it means they can be gotten rid of permanently. So one way that I is in observing, being more mindful about the nature of my mind. Who here knows there's two qualities to the mind? And actually, if you don't know yet from the mind courses, what do you think are the two characteristics of your mind? The qualities of your mind. There's two main ones in Tibetan Buddhism. Any ideas what your mind is? If you don't know, if you haven't done the courses, somebody newer, that what do you think? I'm just curious. It's always active. Okay. The mind seems to be always active. What other kind of qualities are there? It's a sea of consciousness. A sea of consciousness. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thinking. The mind thinks, right? Other experiences of your own mind. What do you experience when you think of your mind? Molecules? And? Emotions. Yep. Emotions. And? Solutions. Yep. Lazy. Okay. Okay. So all of these things you could say are, there's actually two main qualities, some of which are contained in some of the things you've said. The mind is clear. It has a clear, light nature, like a spacious luminosity. What do you think of that? You know, some people are like, my mind? You know, where is that, right? And where is that when I get stressed? Huh? You know, a lot of people think busyness is the nature of their mind, right? Isn't it? Because it's a, you know, there's, okay. The second quality is awareness. Awareness, thinking, solutions, emotions, awareness, okay? Okay, so it's clear, the mind is clear and knowing. That's it. Clear and knowing. That's your mind. Okay, and it's not the brain. The mind is a non-physical, non-material, has no color, shape, form, odor. You cannot touch it. You cannot open up your body and under a microscope say, there's the mind. And basically, the mind attaches to the body, and this is Tibetan Buddhism, right? Because we believe in past lives and things, and as there's a subtle, most subtle wind that is the basis of your body. Okay, and I'm going to call this most subtle wind a type of energy. In Tibetan, the word is lung. Lung is wind. Okay, it's a type of energy, and it's physical in matter, physical in nature. So that absolutely, something physical can create something physical, and that's your body. Okay, and we know this kind of energetic things from other spiritualities. So in the Hindu Ayurvedic system, it's called prana. In the Chinese system, it's called qi. That's energy. It's a type of life force. Okay, and that creates your body. It's physical in nature, the wind. But the wind exists on a most subtle level, it exists on a subtle level, and it exists on a gross level. This is a gross wind. You know, you can hear it, you kind of see it, gross wind. That creates the body, this most subtle wind, okay? And it's there at the moment of conception, it allows conception to take place, okay? And at that moment of conception, Tibetan Buddhism says the most subtle mind, non-physical in nature, at that point mounts the most subtle wind like a rider on a horse, and it rides along with that body, as long as those most subtle winds exist. Okay, and then you have your life. And what it does is that most subtle mind comes in, mounts on the most subtle wind, separate from it, not of it, but that most subtle mind contains seeds and propensities based on past activities that mind has done in whatever form it's in, and they make imprints in that consciousness, okay, and those seeds of that most subtle mind, as soon as it attaches and rides along with the most subtle wind, starts to dictate how that life is going to be, what form you're going to take, how beautiful or intelligent you will be, how deformed you will be, how long you will live, and all that. Now, you can alter those seeds based on everything we do, think, and say in this lifetime. Okay, and then as we age, and as you know, the aging process is the gross nature starts to change. Physical changes in the body, right? Hair turns gray or white. Your eyesight changes. Your knees hurt. It's natural because the subtle winds start dissolving and absorbing and changing and degenerating. Why? Because that's natural. Just a natural process, you know. And eventually you're left with this, all the gross winds absorb, and when you actually physically die, there's one more exhalation of that gross wind, and then that's finished. And then you have the subtle winds. They start dissolving, right? So even after you're clinically dead, according to the West, there's a whole other world happening for you. The consciousness is there riding along, right? And then the subtle winds absorb, and all you're left with is the most subtle wind. You know, and then when that dissolves, nothing more for the consciousness to hold on to, and it leaves that form and goes on looking for another form. Okay, it's all natural process. So that's the mind, the consciousness. In Tibetan Buddhism, located here, in an indestructible drop, in a subtle energy system that you cannot see, but it exists in the body with various energy networks, chakras at different places, and it exists in this indestructible drop until it leaves the body, like that. Okay. So the mind is clear and knowing, interesting, clear and knowing. So sometimes if you get stressed, another technique is to remind yourself about the nature of the mind. My mind is not stress. You know I feel stressed right now, but my mind is actually, that's not the nature of my mind. And what it is, it's a delusion that passes through the mind for a certain period of time. You know, and it's temporary. You don't always feel stressed. Is there anyone in here that always feels stressed and anxious? Seriously, I know people have anxiety and panic attacks, clearly, but they end. They don't go on all the time. I even mentioned to chronically depressed people, okay, they can remember a time before they were depressed. Okay, so it's not forever and always. Sometimes it's for years, but you can change it. It's possible to change it because there was a time preceding it before it started. So you have to start to remind yourself about this when these stressors come up. Okay? Slowly you practice. So what we do if we have a meditation practice is you develop a little place in your house, a cushion. It doesn't have to be a fancy thing. Some people use their sofas, but it depends how many people you live with and what the space is like, and some people just make a little corner of the room, a place where you can sit that isn't heavily trafficked. And what you do is, a lot of times I would bring my stressors back to that cushion, and that cushion became a home for me, where I would look forward to going there to work out why I got so stressed that day. Because when you're in the stress in the moment, and if somebody's in your face that you might think is causing the stress, right? I don't have time right then to deal with it. But when I go home and I can be quiet and sit down, then I can get some perspective and say, what happened? You know, why did I lose it with that person? What? And you really need to get clear and analyze. That's analytical meditation. Go back in. What really happened? What did he say? And then what did I say back? And then he said that or she said this. And I really go back and I would look at it. Sometimes again and again, and look at it. And then I'd start to ask myself, what if I had said something different at that moment? You know, and I actually introduce that into my mind, where you can role play a different thing I would have said. And I say it again. And I'll go through the thing again and say it again. And say it again. Right? So you practice in that way. You know, or also noticing the triggers that caused the anxiety. And then I start to slowly remove the triggers and possibly put myself with healthier people, you know, make sure that I'm not late for work, because then that created this tension, make sure I got to the project or the work in time, got it done on time, you know, didn't put too many things on my plate so that I was always late. Like, these are stressors, these are triggers to create a huge stressful scene for you. Okay, so we want to get wise about our behavior. Is this making sense a little bit? Okay. So let's get wise. Like, one of the things I did, and I'll go back to the nature of the mind in a minute. One of the things I used to do is, when I lived at one retreat center in California, we were buried in the woods. And to get to the main, I mean, there was one little town, but to get to the main town, it was 40 to 45 minute drive to go there. So I ended up just going out a couple times a week to do errands, that I would do. And what I would do is, because I didn't want to go out more than that, I would load up my list with too many things to get done in the time that I had. And because it was all a small town, most probably I would run into someone I knew, and they would want to talk or have a cup of tea or at least tell me what they think I should be doing with the center. You know, they always wanted some time for that. But basically, you know, it'd be nice to, you know, have a little bit of time to talk to the person. But I would have my list of, you know, far too many things to do. And then in the middle of the day, I'd be completely stressed because I didn't finish this, and none of the things were super essential, but they had to be done. But nothing was life threatening. But so I didn't like this habit I was doing where, and then I'd meet someone, I'd say, oh, hi, but I gotta go because I've got this. When here's a human being, but what's more important is this, I thought, okay. So, and then when I would leave them and rush off, then I'd feel guilty. I didn't have any time to talk. You know, these are all these little things that go on and make us feel kind of not happy with ourselves. And so I started to make my list before I'd go out, and of course it was too long. And then what I started to do was meticulously and quite consciously make a second list of half of what was on the first list. And so I wasn't going to get everything done, but I would just pick the priorities. A lot of it is prioritization of your life in a wise and compassionate way. And I make the second list, and then I'd head out. Right? And the day was so much more spacious. So much more spacious. And sometimes even I found that I had, you know, 10 minutes, and I, you know, took myself to a cafe and had a cup of coffee or something. Like, what a luxury. Right? Why not? Because that will de-stress you. If you're in the middle of stress, that's a nice thing, is have a cup of tea with yourself. You know, certainly with someone else, but you can do it with yourself. And then what would happen is, of course, I would run into someone I knew, but now I had 10 minutes. And it was nice. We'd have a little, sometimes it'd just be at the post office, 5-minute little yim-yam, we call it. Little, and it was nice. We felt a little connection. So another combat for, the stressors, you said isolation. So when you connect with people in a positive, healthy way, it lessens your stress and anxiety. You know, it's a nice thing to connect like that. You know? So it was just a little technique. You figure out and be creative in your own life of what suits, what fits your lifestyle, but that was something I learned, that don't load everything up like that, because it will just create overwhelm. Just, you know, you had said, I don't finish anything. You know, and then you don't feel good about yourself. I never get this. So just make a few less things. Is that possible to do? I know you're all busy city people, but it's possible. Right? Sometimes you tell yourself, I can't. I can't not finish this. I can't. So prioritize. But again, I add those words in a wise, compassionate way. Because sometimes we prioritize in a really stupid way, right? You know, I've got to get to the cat dancing cat videos. That's important. Right, but it's not important. Like, do really, you know, you're all intelligent people, so you know basically how to monitor that. Okay. So the mind, clear knowing. And so when you, those of you that have done some courses on the mind or would like to do, you start to become aware of a little bit that when my mind feels lazy and it feels busy and it feels cluttered, and that's not actually the nature of my mind. Okay, so four things in general that help you counter anxiety and stress. And one of them is this mindfulness, this awareness of the nature of the mind. Four things in general that help you counter. Just reminding myself when I'll feel, and I'll think, you know, wow, I feel so stressed right now, but that's not really how my mind is working. So let me look at the stress. Let me look at what's happening. If I can't do it right now, I must make time later today. Or I'll go back to my cushion, my meditation space, and I really want to look at what triggered this. And if it's continual, where every day you're feeling stress, look at it, seriously analyze it, and instigate some life changes. What can I do so that I'm not continually in this space? Possible? Possible? So let me go to another, let me go to some specific. So another thing I like to do, I mentioned this just briefly, is de-attach from the stress and anxiety. So I mentioned, I'll say, wow, I have a lot of anxiety right now in the mind. You know, so it's not that I'm anxious. I'm not an anxious person. And I don't have the anxiety glommed together with my mind. But I watch it like clouds in the sky. Okay, so you have a clear blue sky. And occasionally clouds come in, right? But you know that they're not the nature of the sky. You know that it's separate from the sky. And it's a certain thing of the moisture, and then a cloud arises. And sometimes you can watch clouds. And they very quickly move and shift. And occasionally you've got, and actually maybe more than occasionally in London, the entire clear blue sky is obscured by a huge cloud bank, right? It's common. But the thing is, you know that's not the sky. And you know behind that is the sky. And you can see when you take off in a plane and you go through the clouds and then suddenly it's clear. It's clear like that if you get high enough, okay? So sometimes I like to think of my mind like that. Anxiety comes in a delusion. Stress comes in as delusion. And it's just like clouds in the sky, okay? So right now, if you're very, very anxious, it's a heavy bank of rain clouds, dark, foreboding, like that. Sometimes it feels like that. Okay, but again, the clouds shift and move, and if I don't attach any more importance to them, they shift and move more quickly. So that's why I'll say, well, I have, even with other delusions, well, I have a lot of anger in my mind right now. And I just observe it, rather than I'm an angry person. I'm an angry person is very solid. You know, I'm an anxious person, much more concretized. Okay, so one way is detach a little bit from the experience in your mind. And then you can just observe it. Okay. So when we did the meditation, the brief meditation, and I said, and then you notice your mind is distracted and off the object of the breath. And then I said, but with any further story or elaboration, and gently, I said, so with gentleness, you bring your mind back to the breath. Okay? So one of the issues we have in our cultures, and I find this a lot in the West, like a plague, is low self-esteem. And I just spent about 7 months in India and Nepal, and my Asian brothers and sisters, they don't have it as much as we have it, somehow. They do have some, you know, but not as heavy as we have it. In fact, in Tibetan, in the etymology, the language, they don't have a word for guilt, right? Can you imagine? You know, it really attracted me to Tibetan Buddhism. I was like, "Sign me up! I'm there." Imagine no word for guilt. They a little bit they've expressed. I noticed people would express where they'd say, "I felt bad. This happened, and I felt bad." But it's very interesting not to have a word for guilt in your language, like that. So we feel guilty. We have issues, and that lends to stress and anxiety. And so so partly from that, I find if you are gentle with yourself, and Lama Yeshe used to say this, one of our teachers, be gentle with yourself so you will be gentle with all others. It has to start here. It has to start in yourself. And we grind ourselves. Okay, so something happens, and let's say you go to work and you get angry at somebody and you snap at somebody. Or like Jerry said, when you get stressed, you notice that one of the byproducts could be that I say something really rude to someone. You know, I use lousy language. So when it happens, then we feel bad about ourselves. And in the moment it might have felt good, but you realize it's not a great thing. And later I'll go home, and sometimes what happens is when you do this one thing, what delusion in the mind does, And what I also mean is an unenlightened consciousness, which is most ordinary beings, it's natural, okay, is we obsess about that experience then. We love to circle and turn around it again and again and again. And I said that to him, and then I said that, and then I said, and how could I have said that? And I said it again, and thank you. So that's a form of analytical meditation. You know, analytical meditation is a form of meditation we use, but that kind of analytical meditation is focused on the wrong thing. Okay? So it's one thing to do analytical meditation and you analyze why it's advantageous to be a human. You know, all the advantages we have as a human. And then it creates a sense of you really valuing your human rebirth. It's great to be a human. There's many things you can do worthwhile with your life. You know, and check it out, because the animal realm, is a realm we interact with, it's seen as a lower realm of existence. And you might say, I mean, the pets we have in our realm are the peak of the animal realm. Okay, so I know some people that say, well, I'd rather be my dog because he stays home all day, lies in the sun, and I have to go to work to feed him, right? Okay, but you're not seeing the whole animal realm. And honestly, I just came from Asia. I just came from two undeveloped, India's nearly developed, developing countries. Nepal doesn't appear to be developing very much, and the animals there, the way dogs are, it's sickening at times. It's really very sad, very, very sad like that. So the animal realm, it's not a great scene. So when you really analyze, I was just checking out the cat that lives here, the black cat, I go through this door and she's there, you know, and I think it's really a food thing. You know, she's there, and I come through the door, and she's, meow, meow, meow. I mean, it just went on last night for ages, and I like animals, but I'd come down and I'd pet her, and I think it was really directed at food. She did, you know, cats are very specific. It's all about them, right? They're very clear about it. You know, you must analyze and really see how the animal lives and how many advantages you have as a human. If we fully appreciated that existence, which a lot of Westerners do not, you would have healthy self-esteem. And it's actually one of the major antidotes to depression, is valuing your human life, appreciating it, seeing all the wonderful qualities and things you can do like that. Okay? So you analyze, and you come from different ways. You know, you look at what it would be like to be the black cat out there, and what would it be like to be this, and you analyze. But what happens is we do analytical meditation with the fact that I snapped at that guy at work. Now I feel really bad. He thinks I'm a jerk. Everyone in the office is afraid of me. This is what we do. We come from every angle, and it goes on for months, right? It's one thing to go home and analyze what happened today. I basically got knocked down by a delusion, like a wave. Boom. And one of my friends, in Sanskrit, the word is klesha. That's delusion, klesha. And one time, when I was living in this Buddhist community, we had meetings every week of the community and all these people, and we'd discuss what we wanted to do with the community, make decisions. And I was the director at the time, and one of the longtime founders of the center at one point didn't like the decision I was going to make and stood up across the table and started yelling at me, which was quite out of character for her, but she was very upset and emotional, and I was kind of shocking. And all of a sudden, in the middle of it, she was a really long-term practitioner. She caught herself, and she suddenly looked at me, and she said, "I'm having a klesha attack." Like, really, no, but it was very powerful, because she got it, and she realized she didn't need to be yelling at me, and we were fine, but, you know, and then she calmly sat down and expressed what she was feeling, and it was great. So if you can notice this, where you're having a klesha attack, you're just noticing that. And then you can healthily analyze what happened, and the next time I see the person I yelled at, I'm either going to apologize to them, I'm going to say something kind, I will be very conscious of my speech. These are antidotes that you commit to yourself, really determine. You can say it out loud, you can say it in your mind, in your meditation practice, right? And then let it go. It's over. I did this, but you train yourself, let it go. Otherwise, you just keep obsessing, and it just contributes to, I'm no good. I'm not good enough, you know? I'm an overly stressed, anxious person. It's not who you really are. It's not true. You just had a moment of intense anxiety or stress going through your mind, passing through. Okay? Does it make sense? Am I communicating? Yeah? So these are just little, you know. So here's another general antidote. And the other thing that's important, I mentioned they're temporary, is in remembering the nature of mind, is this anxiety, again, it's temporary. Everything's impermanent. Everything changes. That tends to help people, too. I don't always feel like this. When a panic attack comes, sometimes they're very strong, right? But they're, it will end. It will change. Okay, and then, you know, just remind yourself, bring yourself back to the breath. And just take that deep breath again. It really short circuits the delusion, really lends more space to the mind. Okay? So here's a third thing I wanted to mention, is being non-judgmental. Being non-judgmental. What do you think about that? Right? That's a tricky one. Okay? You have certain thoughts and emotions that come into your mind more naturally. Okay? And you like some thoughts and emotions that come into your mind, and you dislike others. Okay? So what happens is certain mind states come up, and you attach to those and say, this is a good way to think, and certain mind states come up that you don't like, that are less than generous. And then you get averted, and then you start again laying trips on yourself. So what if we just had a little bit more equanimous flow to the mind? And so now I notice through a bit of practice over the years that when I have a negative thought arise, I am much more able to fold it into my practice more gently, rather than like, oh, you know, you're so critical, or you're always negative with that, or, you know, laying a big trip on myself. Instead, it's kind of like, well, there goes a little klesha bubble, then isn't that interesting, that thought? So the first thing is being non-judgmental with yourself. If you can practice with that in the mind, is I love observing the mind more. It's just observing what comes up. It's not always going to be healthy. If you're an ordinary being, you're going to have delusions that come up in the mind. That, again, is natural. But we work with it. You know, so through acceptance, much more acceptance of that in my mind, the whole experience is much more gentle. You know, just watching. So, and in the mind that's caught up in the aversion from this and the attachment to that, it's not a very peaceful place for me. So the nice thing is to cultivate a sense of equanimity. So it's a non-judgmental, loving awareness and acceptance of whatever arises in my mind. Can you cultivate that? Okay, and this is just your own private experience. You know, we all have our private little secret, and you know, people have things in their mind that are really nasty, but you it's your own little private party that you're watching. But really with equanimity, and again, it's loving awareness towards yourself. We don't have enough of that. We don't have enough of that in our culture, really. Right? And I'll watch myself, and sometimes with amusement. You know, something will happen, and I'll see somebody would come to the center, somebody that was, we would call them our most special guests, right? You know, these really challenging guests, that somebody would come, and they're very big in the space, they steal things from the center, they're loud, they're rude, there's things like this. It's just, we're in the service industry at Dharma centers. So you serve anyone. You really are there to serve as many beings as possible. Why? Because people come to these centers and you get help for your mind, and you're happier, you're kinder. That's the point. So people that want to work at centers, they're some of the most incredible people I've met to serve people. And we would get some guests that were a bit challenging, and I would notice that as soon as they walked through the door, my mind would be like, like, here comes jerk face again. Right? And sometimes it would be, you know, nastier than that, okay? I'm just giving you the G-rated qualities. But I would watch it in my mind, and what would happen is initially I would have these thoughts, and I would just really lay a trip on myself. You know, you shouldn't even call yourself a Buddhist. Really, I'd get really heavy with myself. And then I became a nun. You know, I've been a nun for about 14 years. So I became a nun, and a lot of people project things on Buddhists and on Buddhist nuns. We should be perfect. We had a work-study woman, delightful woman. We hired her at the center later. And, you know, she didn't know. She came for the work-study, young woman, and she walked into the room, and I came into the room, and she thought, wow, she's a nun. She must be able to read my mind. She's a nun, you know. I'm a human being. I'm an ordinary being. I'm giving it my best shot, okay? That's all. You know, I'm not that different than you. And but people would project these things, and then there I am sitting at some meeting or something, and my mind is just full of garbage. They'd have no idea, you know. So I would work with it. But initially, I would really get down on myself, that I'm not worthy to be a nun, and I should, you know, but I'm working with it. So now I'm much more able to kind of be like, whew. Like, boy, was that something you had going through your mind there? You know, what is that? But then I'm gentle about it and fold it in and just let it go. Like, there's another little bubble on the surface of the still, calm lake that is truly my mind. And right now I got this agitation. Sometimes it's churned up waves. And then you let it go. And then the bubble returns back into the surface. You know, and I get a little bit more perspective, and then I, you know, and more with practice, I could start to look at the person and say, yeah, I had that negative thought about them, but just like me, they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Just like me, they're the same as me. Just like me, they have Buddha nature. They have a potential that can awaken into a fully enlightened being, just like me. You know, now we have two common things. Just like me, they want to be loved. They want to give and receive love, just like me, like that. So suddenly you start to gain perspective and open up to like this. So it's very helpful to be non-judgmental. And what happens is we're in cultures, and I think Americans more than the British are quite good about, you know, a little bit more discretion, I would say, in this culture. But what happens is we have opinions, right? And then sometimes we need to march the opinion out there. And we feel like everybody should hear our opinion. Sometimes it's not a valuable thing to do, okay? So what I found is we also get stories going, correct? About people and things. And you're quite sure that your story's right about the person. And it could be somebody that's continually late for work, could be a family member that irritates you, and they're always doing this. And they're always doing it in this way. And so, and I think I told this story in here in another class. I worked in this community, in this Buddhist community in California, and our cook was a big guy, a bit imposing, and with a sarcastic personality, but a lovely guy, and he was my neighbor and a very close friend. And one morning I came in to the main building where he was working. We all had separate housing, and I walked in, and I'm in my little self-absorbed bubble, as most of us are, and I walked in and said to him, good morning. You know, I was in a good mood that day, right? And he was across the kitchen from me, and he barked something very kind of rude back to me, you know, like he would do sometimes. And I got intimidated and kind of shocked, and I quickly got out of the kitchen and went up to my office and worked for a couple hours. And while I was working, and I was irritated by what he said, and so as I was working, I began to create a huge story about him in my mind, that he had to say something rude once again, as he always says, and he's always so sarcastic, and I really don't like that he's sarcastic, and now he's down there cooking lunch with his anger for the retreaters, and all that anger's going into the food. And he's holding the center hostage with his anger, and I'm just sick of it, and you know. And by 2 hours later, I was furious at him, right? From this little thing, and then a staff member comes into the office, says to me, "Did you hear what happened to Jim this morning?" This is the cook, and all I had to hear was his name, and I said, "What?" Right? I don't want to hear about him, right? And then this woman says, well, he was sick this morning, and a month before he had landed in the hospital for 5 days with this sickness, and he basically thought he was having the same attack, which he wasn't, but he thought he was. And as a result of that, he had a fight with his partner because she started accusing him, you're not taking care of yourself again. They had a huge fight, and then they couldn't find one of their cats. And we lived in a wooded area, and sometimes they disappeared because the coyotes ate them. And so this was his morning. And what happened is, by the time all this happened, and he thought he was sick, it was too late to find a replacement cook. So because he had a responsibility to cook, he turned up in the kitchen to do his job with this whole horrible morning that he had had. So now there I am at my desk, and I hear this story, and then I have a little, like, wah, wah. You know, boy, am I ever wrong, right? Totally got it wrong. But I was very invested in my story, but it was completely wrong. You know, there was an accuracy to it, but it was wrong. And until, for those of you that have studied emptiness, some people in here have studied, read about emptiness, the nature of reality. So until you've had a direct perception of emptiness, your story is always partially wrong. And I found that refreshing to find out. So that you'd get a story going, you have your judgment, and I still get judgments and stories, and now as I march it out there, I'm much better able to get the reins to kind of pull the horse back and say, you know, that's not totally accurate. You know, and it's very liberating. It's very liberating to know that your story is wrong. So you can let go of the judgment like that much more easily. Is I don't really know about this person. Until you have a high level of realization and know somebody's mind, you don't know what's going on for them, right? So that alleviated a lot of stress and anxiety for me, you know. And then you can just go back to practicing loving kindness towards others. You know, how can I help people? That's the premise of Buddhism. How can I be of service to more and more beings, more fully, like that? So let me go into a practical thing, and we'll have some questions. Practically, though, life is really full, especially in a city like London. The tube was crowded today. And just my seeing it, I mean, India's crowded. And it's such an interesting thing about India and the West. Okay, so we went to teachings with the Dalai Lama in South India. I just was at these teachings. There were 30,000 people there, and they were set up at this one monastery, Ganden Monastery. And there were some teaching spaces, and some of the spaces were not very spacious, and people were crowded in. And the monks sit like one on top of another, like that. But Westerners, we need our space, right? Our space. Think about this, our space, okay? As if there is such a thing that exists as my space. Okay, now I know some of you own homes, and some of you pay rent on flats, and in a sense, you can make it yours, and you can put your books up, and you can, I'm a little bit homeless right now, so I'm in this kind of, my, you know, somebody said, where do you live? And I'm like, my 20-inch roll bag, like, there it is. And so, but, and it is nice to have a nest and to have a base, there's no question about it. But again, everything's temporary, you know, and if you understand the changing nature of things, it alleviates a lot of stress, and if you don't resist it so much, right? I lived in California for many years. There were earthquakes, okay? So sometimes one big earthquake cracked my friend's house and it cracked the building I worked in, and it was quite dramatic, okay? But if you understand that this is the nature of things, they things wear out and things break and people die, okay? And it's inevitable that those things happen. So the more I resist that, the more I will suffer and the more tension I'll have in my life. So one thing is about the changing nature of things. If you can explore that, and if you want to start with small changes in your life, how do you respond to change? How do you respond? Or some of you, just in general? Okay, yes. Right, what happens when it's not initiated by you? What's your anxiety? And what were you saying?
Yeah.
Anxiety kicks in, right? People have that experience, you know. And it could be simple. Okay, here's a simple change. you're going out to dinner, you're meeting friends, they're going to this restaurant, and at the last minute, we're not going to that restaurant. You really like that restaurant. You want that restaurant, okay? So how do you deal with that? If you can deal and start to practice with the little changes in your life, okay, and you get really good at those of just going with the flow, and it doesn't mean you don't assert yourself sometimes to say, well, actually, I really need to go to that restaurant over there because it's closer to my office, and I told you I could only take off that much, so I need to be over there. That's one thing to say. It's okay to be clear like that, but you can't resist every little change in the agenda that happens. So experiment first with the small changes. How am I doing with that? Some of you do well, some of you not at all, right? But then you'll be better once you practice with the bigger changes in your life. The biggest change will happen is your death. That's going to be a big one. So if you're already rehearsing with many smaller things and you start to look at death, that it's inevitable, it will make it much more peaceful for you, okay? But one of the things I was enamored, and just to go back to the seating at the teachings with my Asian sisters and brothers, is in India there's, 1.25 billion people now in India, right? And the Indians, fortunately, are coming to the Dharma. And there's a whole section devoted to them. And their section happened to be right in the front this time at the teachings. And I say, God bless, because it's their country. They're having these teachings. Now they're coming to the teachings, and they're really into it. And they're great. And they have some centers in India, and I teach at some of those centers. So they were kind enough, of all the foreigners that were there, including us, you know. Well, when you normally sit at teachings at a lot of our centers in the West, the monks and nuns are supposed to sit up front. That's just protocol, right? And in the West, we tend to put them side by side, but in Asia, the monks sit in front of the nuns. It's no big deal, but they sit in the front, in front of lay people. When I've gone to these teachings since 1990, I think the first time, or 87 was the first teaching, but 1990 was more of an organized big teaching. The foreigners, they don't sit in front, they sit in front of the monks and nuns. They sit wherever, as close up they can sit, as they can sit, basically, with no regard for any Western, any foreigner monk and nun to sit in front of them. But the Indians, no. They wanted us to sit up front. They wanted some of us to sit up front. So they let a few of us sit in their section, right? And then this new group of Indians came from another area that didn't speak much English, and they came in a huge group, and I noticed everybody just made room to fit them in. It was a tiny little space that we had already sorted everybody sitting, and then this group of like 30 people came to sit down. And you know what? They all fit in. We all fit in there together. I was amazed. I saw them coming, and I was like, where are we going to put these people? I've got my space now. So they can't sit in my space because it's my space. It's not my space. And somehow everybody shifted apart and moved, and suddenly 30 people were sitting down that hadn't been there before. So now if you want to sit in the American section, there wasn't really an American section, but like they would have said, I already saw people saying, well, you can't, there's already people, you can't sit there. We're not making space for you is what you're saying. We're not going to make space for you. So my Indian friends, these two lovely women I was sitting with, they said, it's interesting. Like, we just figure out, there's 1.2 billion of us, and we just figure out a way. The Indians have to figure out a way to make space because there's so many of them. Now, there are rural areas of India where you don't see anybody, but everyone's congested in the cities, and I'm just amazed how they make room for each other. It's beautiful. It's, frankly, I'm always enamored and moved by it. And I've learned a lot if I'm in New York City or other places and people walk down the street and people bump you. And New Yorkers get a bit like, hey, you know? So I've learned more the fluidity. We can be more fluid, and it's quite pleasant. You know, so it's something you could practice on the tube. And, you know, I noticed I was on the tube today, it was very crowded, but somehow I've still got my India mind with me. It lasts a little while. And I noticed that I was jostled around there and moved. And I could have been like, you know, rigid and unhappy, but I just kind of, somebody shifted and then I shifted and there was space. There's always space. Why? Because that's one of the qualities of the mind. So if you find it here and develop it and get in touch with it, because it's always there, that will create external space for you. That's how it works. That's how it works. No space in the mind, then there's no space out here. Okay? Everything's a reflection back of what's going on in your mind. And did you notice that when you're in a good mood one day, how it's okay, you know? This didn't, well, this friend canceled lunch, and it's okay. When you're in a bad mood, it's bad out there. It's really bad out there. So I really am so enjoyed that time with the Indians and just how they, and it really teaches me a lot of how they go through space, and the Tibetans as well, and other Asians. They just manage to fit it in, and they don't have such a rigidity about my space, and you know, and it doesn't mean you can't protect your things, but there's always room to kind of let somebody else in and like that. So one thing would be about cultivating your meditation practice, making the space in the mind. The things I mentioned is the awareness of the nature of the mind, being gentle with yourself, being non-judgmental, mindfulness, and things like that. And then, can you be reasonable about how you're living your life? I'm just curious, what are some of the stressors right now in your life? Decisions. And decisions in reference to what? Everything. Okay, so some people are not good decision makers, correct? Some are quite good. Some can do. If you're not a good decision maker, I have a close friend who doesn't make decisions well, you need to practice a little bit. Practice with the little decisions. You know, so some people just, they don't practice, so it's kind of like, I just don't know. And if you even say to them, where do you want to go for lunch? I don't know. Yeah. So practice. Just throw it out there. What happens with people sometimes that don't make decisions, have trouble, is you're very afraid of failure. You know? I've run these centers for, the centers, they're like NGOs, basically, some of them. And maybe 20 years running centers, and then before that, some other administrative things. Before the Dharma, I was running other things. And I made so many mistakes. Unbelievable. So, and some of it was from a poor decision, but I learned. I made the decision. I took the action. I stood behind it. I took responsibility. It was a bad decision. I didn't do it intentionally, you know. And you can always apologize to people, but I learned a lot from it. So I got better at making decisions and less fearful that I was going to fall on my face. Sometimes I fell on my face, you know. I didn't want to purposely offend people and upset people. So you could practice with little things, you know. And what's the whole idea about making decisions? What is really so scary about it when you think about it? If you go in and analyze, you know, what's the problem? And can you get in there to see what is really the problem? Right. I mean, it's good if you watch. And can you make a decision when you're not stressed? Can you find a way to make... Of course. So one of the things I did, if it's a big decision, I had this decision about a job in two different cities, like far away from each other. And I couldn't decide. You know, so I made a pros and cons list of each one. You know, I just literally put down on a list of paper. And then I weighed them, and I saw, and they were somewhat even. You know, it was really hard, and I asked a couple close friends of just them knowing my personality and living style, everything from living style. But I did it when I wasn't really clear, looking at each thing. How would I feel if I was living in a dangerous city? How did I, you know, I really went through each one, kind of, how did that feel? How was that going to be long term? How did I feel that... this one was paying me more money. Was that really important to me? You know, and like each one, I really weighed it. Sometimes that's helpful with decisions. Is that possible, do you think, to go through them that way? And
I've done so much around decisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I tend to see it's hard
for me. Right. So you know what I would do is I wouldn't ask everybody. Yeah. I would ask a couple valued people. Because if you ask everybody, you end up getting, you know, 15 different answers of, you know. And then we never listen to them anyway, right? Isn't it true? Like you'd ask, you just, some, but sometimes I notice I had a couple valued people that I really trusted, really wise decisions that based a bit in my value system. But what happens is sometimes just talking it out with them, I got to the decision. But if I asked too many people, I got confused. So I found that wasn't helpful to ask too many people. Right. That's fantastic then. And just I would just keep slowly working, you know, knowing that's one of your things, to keep working on it to really decrease the why it has to be such an anxious thing. Because that also becomes a pattern. So like as soon as, I know for my friend, as soon as the decision comes up, it can be even small, she's immediately like, you know. So then in that moment of like, oh no, that you know, is then maybe try to breathe more and then get perspective, why is really this so stressful? I mean, really stressful decisions could be, do you have the heart valve replacement surgery versus, I mean, when you really want to put it in perspective, you know, I know one way that someone was talking in a management seminar I went to about is about perspective. And it's a little hard, but if you, like, first of all, one of the things that makes us stressed is a loss of control, I think, for a lot of people. And then the major thing about that is really, I think, the D word, death, that we're all going to die one day. And that's an ultimate loss, what we would say is a loss of control. Not if you're together with your mind, though. Not if you've kind of got your mind open, and sometimes it's an opportunity. People see it as a changing of clothes, sometimes they say. But so what happens is when you have a stressful decision, and we would obsess about it for a while, and you'd ask a lot of people, and we're not sure we can make the decision, and it contributes to anxiety, and it can be tremendous anxiety. But if I suddenly think about comparing that decision with I could die with my mind not prepared, suddenly this decision becomes not such a major thing. And one way we were using it was there was a woman that came into the seminar with, I'm very concerned about my teenage son. He's flunking out of high school. And it was a big concern, and she was blocked from what she should do about it, kind of conscientiously, you know, which could be getting him a tutor, really focusing him with his homework together, working with him, working with some of the teachers. Like, there were things she could do, but she got kind of paralyzed in it, and she was having these anxiety attacks. And so the seminar leader suddenly said, what's the worst thing that will happen? What's the worst thing that will happen? And she said, he'll flunk out of high school. And he said, no, the worst thing that will happen is he'll die. He'll die soon. You know. And suddenly she was like, suddenly she had another fear, right, that he'll die. But all of a sudden, all of a sudden she kind of popped, and she was like, oh. Like suddenly the high school thing was something she could manage. She suddenly felt like she could manage it. And she took action, and she met with the teachers, and she got, you know, she got him on the right track, and got him back into the school, and you know, and it's interesting somehow when you put it in perspective that, yeah, I am going to die. Am I ready for that? Like these other decisions can be a little bit more manageable. So I don't know if that's helpful, but now she's worried she's going to die soon. So okay. So what was the other thing I was? So then talking about. The actual practice of it is, so what other kind of stressors? So decisions is one. What other things are? And fear that you're left. And what was the thing you said before that? Fear of loss of people. And so this is a common one for people. And this is really hard of grieving for people, losing people. And so again, if you analyze, and it's easier to take your real stressors of what's really stressing you like this, if you analyze, first of all, what can you do about people passing away? What can we do about it? Very little. Other than if you find out somebody has a medically treated ailment, you obviously pursue treatment with them or whatever, or support them in their treatment. And other than that, people die. People die all the time. You know. So it's, and then I would say other seminars I do on death and rebirth or death and dying is take a look at it. Take a look at what that's about, and can you then fully appreciate the time you have with people now that you're loved ones? A lot of times we don't. We take it for granted. So I know a lot of times when I'm parting from my family and close friends, and I really try to be as present as possible with them parting and really say goodbye to them, you know, and just really be there and like, bye, you know, that I really focused on them, because sometimes people die and people that you don't expect, you know, and sometimes I took it for granted and the last meeting wasn't a very good one and you're haunted by the last thing, or we had a little bit of an argument and I was, because you just don't know when it'll be the last time. We do it with old relatives. My grandmother died at 99, and the last 10 years I saw her, I was always like, I wonder if I'll see her again. But why not with just everybody? And pulled in different directions. So the other thing about this is I think it's very healthy to set boundaries and know your limitations. So caregivers, and a lot of us are caregivers here and will be more and more as parents are aging, a lot of us are going through this now, is caregivers need a lot of support, a lot of support. And I think if you are a caregiver, and even if you're a part-time caregiver, and is emotionally often we're caregiving, and you need to take care of yourself in that process, it's perfectly great to do that for yourself. Whether it means you take yourself out to a cafe once a week and have your yummy dessert, whether you take a bath and have a little, you know, you take yourself to a nice film, or that you have your space to sit down and read and do what you want for part of the week, so that you're nourished and renewed. I mean, retreat's a fantastic way to renew yourself, even if it's mini retreats, meaning I only have a couple hours on Sunday, but I want to read that book and do a little study of that thing because it renews you, and I think it's important. And the other thing is just to be clear with people how much time you have and what you can do, and then also just do the best you can do, because you can't do any better than that, right? So sometimes it's difficult, and you can't divide yourself so thinly and spread yourself so thinly because you're ending up not helping anybody. I don't know if that speaks to your issue, but I found I have much more to give when I can clearly set limits. And we had a thing at the center too where people would turn up without any appointment and want to talk to me as the teacher there and the director. And sometimes I was really in the middle of something, even though this was a human being, which was really my purpose for being there. But they would come at a really inconvenient time. So I did a thing where I didn't want to just be like, you know, one time the office manager's like, you know, you need an appointment. You didn't have an appointment with her, forget it. But people would come a long distance. The center was very remote. And so, you know, you always have 10 minutes for somebody. You can always find 10 minutes. So I would give them an undivided 10 minutes. And then I'd say, look, if we need more time, I'd love to spend more time with you. Can we set an appointment? Can we make an appointment? And then I've got an hour to sit with you, however long, and then I, you know. And people often feel like if you have that time a little bit with them, they feel heard, and then they're happy to make more time. So sometimes you can do something briefer initially, and then make more time when you have it. I found that alleviates some of the stress like that. What other stuff is going on for you? Yes. Right. Yes. So the other thing is you can't make other people happy. And there's some people that will always choose misery. Like again, they always choose suffering again and again and again. And I've learned a little bit from these people that I'll be very clear, and I always try to come from a good motivation. You know, again, wisdom and compassion, informed by wisdom and compassion. However much wisdom and compassion you have, and this is a path to developing fully manifest wisdom and compassion. So what we're doing is we all have a level of it, and I just would try to come from there and say, you know, I really want to be with you, and I really want to, you know, and this is the amount of time I have today to do this. And I'm sorry I don't have more time, but I'm really going to be here for this amount of time. And I think people feel that, and then they're like, oh, okay, well, you just have an hour, so, okay, I better get my stuff out in an hour. And then if we need more time, I've got some more time next week. And because there are people that will take from you. So again, I had to limit. You know, running centers, there's a lot of people that came to the centers, and that's part of what I'm doing. But I had to be clear because there were people that were just a drain. And whatever they came to you for, and if they would ask advice, I'd find some people never followed the advice. So after a while, I would go to people that really were trying to practice and do stuff that was. So then I would just end up having to limit the other stuff because some people just wanted to talk and obsess about how bad they feel about themselves, or, you know, so you can make some time, but, and, you know, and then they just try to make you feel bad, but I didn't take it on. I was like, okay, you feel that way, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's hard letting that one go, but I practice a little bit like that. So in general, questions, comments, and other stressors you're having that we can work with? When people have a lot of
long-term conditions,
yes,
or are addicted to something and they're not taking care of themselves,
right, right,
and it's very frustrating because you want that person to be healthy and take care of themselves, but they're not.
Right. So, what can you do about it? Seriously.
Well, you can't make it.
Right. Right. And you can't change them. That's the hard part. So mainly, like, I've learned over years, like, you get into a nagging syndrome, you know. You need to stop drinking, or you need to, you know, there's a lot of that in our lives, and they don't want to hear it, and they're not going to change. So basically, you can say something once or twice, or, you know, and then I would just let it go, and then, because they're not going to follow. It's like, give the information. Let them do with it. You know, if they don't ask your help or advice, it's really tricky because they're not soliciting it. But if it is disturbing you and it's upsetting a family or friends or an environment, sometimes you can very clearly explain, like, we've done that at centers where we just, you know, this is not our culture and our values to have you screaming in the kitchen at people. You know, it's just not what we do here. So I'm sorry, and I know you're frustrated, and maybe we can sit down and help you with what you're frustrated about. And maybe there's some improvements we can make in the kitchen if you want that, but this isn't something that we're going to have here, you know, and things. So even in a family and with friends, we've done that with alcoholics, and, you know, and it's always like, I only have one beer a day, but they're a raging alcoholic, and the one beer really sets them off. And so the question is, as a bodhisattva, be very skillful, because it doesn't mean you're a codependent. Bodhisattvas will set limits because they're there to benefit others and to help others. And so allowing an alcoholic to just have a couple beers a day, you know, because that's what he wants and it's really okay and I can make it sound, and it's not. And if they're destroying a family and they're really upsetting people, is, you know, there are interventions. And again, the best ones are informed with wisdom and compassion. And just, you know, set some limits and say, this, you know, we can't have this in the house, or it's not helping the children, and you can't be raging like this, or go, you know, it's just not working. And let's find some creative solutions so that something is going to work for all of us, not just for you. And if they really don't want to do it, then you take more serious action. You know, whether somebody needs to leave a community or a household or a job, or sometimes that happens if you're in that situation. And otherwise, I would say with really unhealthy people, there's, you know, when you're new to the Dharma, a lot of your world and your friends are not into Buddhism at all. And it doesn't mean they're bad. You don't have to be, you know, there's wonderful people in other traditions. But sometimes I was around people that were really unhealthy. And so then I just started to slowly, I didn't like totally shut off friendships with people, but I slowly started to limit the time I did and what the activities we did when we were together. So I didn't want to go to bars after a while and do heavy drinking with people. So what happened is I was still with these friends, but then I started to suggest, do you want to go for a walk in the park tomorrow? And initially it took them time to adjust as well. Or what I would do is show up in the bar like a half an hour before I knew they were going to leave. So I was just in there half an hour. And slowly I started to kind of do things like that. So initially I was a bit younger and they would judge me and say, oh, you're too good for us. But as people matured, the friends that really stuck with me and we supported each other, we're still friends today, and they're not Buddhists. And they're great and they really love what I'm doing. I love what they're doing. And there's a couple friends that we've really drifted apart because they continue to perpetuate a really unhealthy lifestyle. So I don't see them as much anymore, but you never let people out of your heart. I never felt like that. But after a while, one friend, unfortunately, is very needy and really made some very bad choices in her life again and again. And so I just, I phone her a few times a year and let her go on and on about how horrible her life is and just listen. And that I just had to limit because she was just taking and draining and, things like that. So you just offer as much as you can. I think, I don't know if that's helpful, like that. Yes. Well, the thing is, it can become a habit. And there's people that were severely abused as kids and some horrible patterns in families, and they were always having these stressors and around them constantly, and they learned coping mechanisms based on that. And there's other stressors we have of life. Like some people I know grew up extremely poor where they didn't know where the next meal was coming. These are stressful things. So I think it's basically, again, by doing various meditations and analytical meditation where you go in and really analyze karmically what created the propensity. This is just what happened in my childhood or my youth, but I'm not in that situation anymore. And I don't have to hang on to that behavior pattern or the coping mechanisms like that. Like it's past. Some people have done therapy can be enormously helpful with long-term patterns like that to go in, but I find meditation's a great form of therapy to go in and analyze. And also the practice of, which is hard for a lot of us, letting go. Letting go of that happened, I acknowledge what happened, and that's not happening anymore. I'm making really good choices, and I'm with these in this really healthy scene, and there really aren't stressors like that. So I don't need to have my life informed by that level of stress. I don't know if that helps a bit, anxiety. I'm not an anxious person. It just happened to be a period of time that created that situation. And aren't we fortunate in some ways? And I don't know your particular life, but honestly, just coming from India, my God, the way some people are living, I'm just like, every day I'm just like, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you that I have the life I have, that I'm not living under a bridge. I'm not living in like a plastic tarp. And, when people are poor in India, they're really poor. Sometimes you're just sleeping on the side of the road with nothing. And we don't live like that. We talk about shelters. Probably, I'd imagine, I don't know, but everyone in here has a bed to sleep in that has heat in the house in this season. And that's a luxury in some countries, and it's great that we have it. So there's a lot of things I find from travel, and a lot of people in England travel quite a bit. You really appreciate what you have when you come home, especially if you're going to a developing country. And it's a little problematic with the States because we're isolated. And a lot, some people go to Mexico and Canada, and they might go to the Caribbean for a little holiday, and sometimes they come to Europe. And that's about it. So they're not as exposed to people really struggling, and it puts your life in perspective, you know, when you go home and you see how good it is. And so sometimes that helps to alleviate chronic anxiety situations, is again appreciating what we have like that. So yeah, the time, I know we're over time, but is somebody back there, you had a question that... Yes, and I know that the economy has stressed a lot of people out. My niece and nephews are in their 20s, and finding a good job and keeping it, and in the States getting benefits for the job. Two of my nephews live in London, and two of them live in the States. And it's a whole different time from when I was getting my first jobs and things like that. So it adds a lot of pressure to that. You know, the cost of living in London is unbelievable, like that. Yeah, who just said to me today, I said something about, I think it was to my nephew, that he looked down at my boots, and I had these boots that I was lugging around on the trip because of coming to London. You know, they're waterproof. And I said, yes, I said, I took them up to the mountains in Nepal, and they got shredded, their leather, and they got scratched up and from, like, trekking. And then I said, and then I got them shined in India. And then he looked at me, and he turned. He hasn't been to India, but he said, and how much did that cost? Knowing it would be, and I said, it was about 50 cents. You know, I said, so the cost of living, you know, is very different. And so there are those stressors. And again, I just think about putting some things in perspective. You know, and the other thing is, can you simplify your life? Can you simplify your life? It will reduce so much stress. Unbelievable. Some of my friends living well beyond their means, and it's like they're on this conveyor belt of, I got to do that job because I need the money, because we just took out the satellite TV thing, and we have the new, you know, and there are things that, it's not like your kid's education, it's not healthcare, it's not these essential things. It's these extraneous stuff of, you know, did you really need to get the newer smartphone because it's the latest thing out, and did I, and there's many things like that that you could reduce some of the stuff and then not be so stressed with the bills and the mortgage and then be glommed onto your work, that if I lose my job, you know, they're laying off people at work, and if I lose my job, what am I going to do? And so I find to simplify life so much has been such a blessing. And it's not being a nun. It's not like that. It's I was just living in the state of Vermont for almost 6 years, and it's a very unique state in the United States. It was the first state that had state health care. Years ago, they had it. So you're covered, you know, and some of it was based on income, but everybody was covered with something affordable. And it's a state of simple living and hardworking people that grow a lot of their own food. And they're very resourceful people. And they're basically, their motto is they use things up, they wear them out, or they trade them. And that's Vermont. It's not about, you know, I think I'll get another pair of running shoes. My old running shoes are fine, but I think I'll get another pair just because I want them. You know, it's not that kind of mentality. I was very impressed with the people there. And so I think, can you find ways to reduce and just look at your budget for a month? And I'm sure there's something you can cut out, that, and then you're not going to have that edge of, I need this much. You know, a lot of times we tell ourselves we need this much to live on, but you actually could be quite happy on a bit. Maybe it means eating out like two less times a month, and cooking at home. And sometimes when you cook at home, you eat much better in some ways, you know. So different simplified things like that. Yeah, yes. It's very challenging right now. I'm quite challenged by the externals at times. And so it's horrible what happened in Paris. And it just seems like there's a little bit more terrorism stuff all the time. And it's, you know, and also I just notice a little bit the kind of military states that are cropping up, like the United States. And even in India, because of the Taj bombing, and they had very serious attacks there. And so there were certain places you went and everything, the metal detectors, and they look under the car, and they you know, and it feels, in the United States, it's a lot like that, and it doesn't feel good. It feels fearful. So I think, again, it's you just have to ask yourself, what's the best I can do? And I did a lot of political work before I was into Buddhism. I was involved in politics in Washington, D.C., and I thought that was a way to bring about positive change in the world. But it just circles around and goes around. And I notice when I go on retreat for 4 months or so, and I don't get any news or anything, and when I go on retreat, there's conflicts in this part of the world, and these people died, and this happened. And then when I come down, there's a conflict in this part of the world, and it just shifts around. So I found what helped for me was internal and external work. So I do my internal work, my meditation, my practices, as best as I can, with a good motivation. And that seems to change the external reality for me in a way, where my particular smaller communities are more peaceful, and I'm around more peaceful people, and people that are contributing in good ways to the planet. And yet that external, bigger external picture is there. So there's a lot of people I can pray for. And what happens when I do longer courses on stress and anxiety, we have more time to do meditation and to integrate it with real examples of other things. And one of the, I wanted to go into one other thing, but the, so we have a little bit more time to go into more specific examples. And so Tonglen meditation, which is giving and taking, it's a specific meditation you can learn, it's very nice, is like if I go on the news in the morning and there's something like that, I can do it right then. And it doesn't change necessarily the world, but I do feel like it shifts something in my mind. I'm a part of the world. That changes the world to that degree. And it's serious. If I get myself enlightened, I'm one less mess out there that people have. I'm one less explosion of delusions, vomiting delusions on somebody else. I'm one less of that. And yet also externally, I still write letters to people in Congress about things I feel. I still go to marches. I still, you know, there's many things you can do on that level. I give money to certain causes when I can, even if it's a little bit, and I volunteer for things when I can, and then teach as much as I can around the world, which my teachers ask me to do, that seems to benefit, help people's minds sometimes, give them ways to. So I think that, you know, you contribute as best as you can, but I think you have to do the internal work too, to disengage, because as soon as I open my mouth in anger at somebody, I'm creating a little act of terrorism right there, you know, on some level. So the gentler I can be, it creates that ripple in the world. That's what I've been able to do. Yes? Yes. It's true. And it can connect people, tragedies. Yeah. Really tend to connect more people. And it's a shame we need a tragedy to connect, but it does bring people together. Yeah, absolutely. You know. So we're out of time. I had some more things I was going to go. We're out of time right now, so it's nice if we sometimes have time for a little bit more of. This was a short evening, but I'd like to dedicate. One thing I'd like to do is just in closing, we always dedicate any positive energy that we have created from being together, and that we might have generated here. We're going to send that out into the world, and particularly for all the families of the people in France who have been harmed. And I also honestly like to pray for the perpetrators, because I believe in reincarnation, and I know that when you, I just feel like when you create something like that, you're gonna suffer, you know, even if you die and whatever. And they really need compassion like that, because they're so confused, so utterly confused to create suffering like that. So for all those beings, and there's conflict all over the planet, so for all the beings experiencing conflict, I'd like to offer our merit, our positive energy to them. And I'm sorry, I just wanted to, wait, is there any more specific thing I was gonna say about, but maybe we'll save it for another time, because I know it's late right now. I had one more thing about anxiety, but I hope this was, mostly that was some of the things that I had gotten through, most of the stuff. I hope it's been useful, and I'd like to, I think in this little booklet again, I think there's dedication, yes. If you turn to page 34 at the back of the book, we're going to read this dedication prayer. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Janju sen chodrim po che ma ke panam ke gyur chi ke wanyam pa me pa yong gon ne gon du pel war jo. At the bottom, for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Gamri ramwe kowe jinkam de pendang de wa malu chungwe ne chen re zik wang ten jing gato yi sharpe si te bardu tengyur ji. So may we progress along a path to full awakening as quickly as possible, because then we can really be a benefit to all others. And please protect your mind, be skillful with your minds of what information's coming in, what you watch on TV, what you read, magazines, movies, and internet surfing. Is if you have healthy imprints going in, there's a lot of violent stuff on you know, out there. So if you have healthy imprints going in, it's gonna create a little gentler, peaceful scene. For you, it's a way to protect your mind, and may you use that, you know, the way you develop your mind in a skillful way like that, that'll be more peaceful. And if you're doing the best you can do in life, you know, you mentioned lazy, and, you know, we know when we're being lazy, so if we can pop ourselves out and make a little bit of effort, and you know you're doing the best you can do, it alleviates a lot of anxiety. You know, because I ask myself a lot of times, I saw people in India, I saw the worst deformity I've ever seen in my life in Calcutta, like a month ago. I've never seen, I mean, I believe there was a woman under there, but it was unbelievable. And I was like, what can, you know, it's horrible, and you feel anxious about it. And then I think, what can I do? And so I did whatever I could do for her, you know, the best I could do. And I had to let it go, because there's only so much you can do. You can't fix everybody, you can't take everybody home, and you can't. So I did what I felt, and I always ask myself, is there something I can do here? And then do it, act on it. If there's nothing you can do, let it go, let it go. But then I feel peaceful with myself, peaceful like that. So anyway, I hope it's been helpful. And thank you so much for coming. And I'm sorry it's a little bit late, but I appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you again. So thank you very much. And I am teaching in other places if you're interested in England for the next couple of weeks, so I can tell you a little bit about that. And if anybody wants some of the pills, you can come up after and I'll like that. Thank you so much. Joy.